So it's the third teaching, and what we'll do is we'll start with the abbreviated practice, you know, that came from the text. The text gave the expanded practice, and last week I abbreviated it. And so we'll do that abbreviated practice again this time, and together. Okay, so let's start. Do you have the sheets with the prayers?
The ones that we have on them? Thursday night since.
We also have the recitation. I think we're using the blue books.
Yeah, we're using the blue books. So. Okay, so everybody who's out there, I can't see you today, but hopefully you can see me, but I will visualize you. And you can't see me, so maybe, you know, you're enjoying your chips and your Coke during class. Yeah, so let's meditate together and put the chips and the Coke aside, okay? I'll just give you a stomach ache. Okay. So I'll read the first part. You can the visualization, and you can visualize, and then we'll do the prayers together. Okay. So start. Let's come back to your breath. Watch your breath a couple of minutes. Let your mind settle down. So when we visualize the Buddha, think that the Buddha is the embodiment of all the wisdom and compassion appearing in that physical form. Yeah, he's the embodiment of the entire path and all the results of the path, and that is being symbolized, being represented, appearing in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha. So in the space in front of you, on a precious throne, both high and wide, supported by eight great snow lions, on a seat of multicolored lotus, moon, and sun disks, is my kind main spiritual mentor, in the form of the conqueror Shakyamuni. So this whole visualization is made of light, and you're not imagining a statue, but really thinking of the Buddha appearing in your mind's eye. The color of his body is pure gold. On his head is the crown protuberance. He has one face and two arms. The right hand touches the earth. The left, in meditation posture, holds an alms bowl full of nectar. He wears the three saffron-colored monastic robes. His body, made of pure light, and adorned with the signs and marks of a Buddha, emanates a flood of light in all directions. Sitting in the Vajra posture, he is surrounded by my direct and indirect spiritual mentors, by deities, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, heroes, heroines, and an assembly of Arya Dharma protectors. So just have the feeling that you're sitting in the presence of a huge assembly of Arya beings and fully awakened Buddhas. And they're all looking at you with kindness, compassion. and contentment. And in turn, at the thought of their compassion and their virtue, a feeling of great faith and confidence and trust in the holy beings arises in us. And then to generate our motivation, let's think, I and all sentient beings who have been my mothers from beginningless time until now have continuously undergone the dukkha or unsatisfactory circumstances of samsara in general, and also the suffering of the three lower realms in particular. This universal experience of being caught in the cycle of rebirth due to ignorance and karma. It's difficult to fathom the depth and breadth of this misery that we're all in. Although if we just open our eyes a little bit and look around, or even think about the news, it's quite apparent. And so think, now that I have attained a precious human life, so difficult to attain, and so meaningful once acquired, if I do not realize supreme liberation in which all the dukkha of samsara is overcome. In other words, if I don't become a fully awakened Buddha, then once again I will have to experience the various torments of cyclic existence in general, and those of the three lower realms in particular. As I now have before me the spiritual mentor and the three jewels who can protect me from this pain, who can lead me out of it, for the sake of all mother sentient beings, I will do all I can to realize precious, perfect, and consummate Buddhahood. To this end, from the depths of my heart, I will take refuge in the spiritual mentors and in the three jewels. So also visualize yourself surrounded by all sentient beings. You can think of your mother on your left side, your father on your right. It doesn't matter if they're still alive or not, you can still imagine them. And as far as you can see, you're surrounded by other sentient beings who, just like you, want to be happy and don't want to have problems. But in spite of that wish, find that problems come our way anyway. And so as we recite the various prayers, then think about the meaning and think that you're leading all the sentient beings around you in generating the feelings and thoughts that are expressed in those verses. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices,
this may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings.
And then we'll recite the Four Immeasurables all together and pause after the last one to contemplate them a little bit. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So try and generate those feelings within yourself towards everybody, not only your friends, but also strangers, and especially the people that you don't get along with or that you're afraid of or who make you feel uncomfortable. Especially wish them to have happiness and be free of suffering, remembering that if they were happy and content inside, they would be acting totally different than how they're acting now. Recite the seven limb prayer and try and think about each line as you're saying it. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the Great Awakening. And then thinking of the universe and everything beautiful in it, especially filling the sky with clouds of offerings, things that you consider beautiful and desirable, things that you would want for yourself, but now you're offering them in even more beautiful form to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. First, to create merit and to develop the feeling that takes delight in giving. And second, to free yourself from attachment to all of these things, knowing that to really follow the path sincerely, we have to give up clinging to the objects. This ground anointed with perfume, flowers strewn Mount Meru, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you. Aversion and ignorance,
friends, enemies, and strangers, my body, wealth, and enjoyments. I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous attitudes.
Idam
Gurana Mandala Kambiryatayami.
And imagine that as you offer the universe and everything beautiful in it to, in multiple copies to all the holy beings, that they experience great bliss. And you also experience a lightness inside because you're giving up your clinging and attachment to these things. Then imagine that a duplicate of the Buddha emerges from the front Buddha that you've imagined and comes to sit on the crown of your head facing the same direction as you, as if he's petitioning the Buddhas and all the other holy beings on your behalf, as we say the requesting verses.
Glorious and precious Root Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown. Guide me with your great kindness. Bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make requests.
Then while we recite the Buddha's mantra seven times, imagine that light flows from the Buddha on your head into you, and also from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so on in the space in front of you. Light flows from them and enters into you through all the pores of your body. And this light purifies all obstacles and sickness, all imprints of destructive karma. And it also brings with it the inspiration of all the holy beings, so that you feel like you've developed qualities similar to theirs, and that you've developed the realizations of the path that they have. So think and visualize like this while we recite the Buddha's mantra seven times. Ayata mani mani maha mani soha. Ayata mani mani maha mani soha. Ayata mani mani maha mani soha. Before we have the teachings, that we're going to listen with an attentive mind and with the wish to learn how to work with our mind, how to free it from its afflictions, how to develop our good qualities, and to do this not simply for our own liberation, not simply for our own happiness and well-being, but by developing these qualities and progressing along the path to awakening, may we increase our ability to be of benefit to all living beings, and then completely culminate that ability by becoming fully awakened Buddhas ourselves. So let's have that as our motivation for sharing this time together. Okay, so last time we talked about the qualities of a Mahayana teacher, remember, and how important it is to check up on somebody's qualities before accepting them as our teacher. That we're the person who decides who our teachers are, you know, and how important it is to really get to know somebody and see that they're qualified before we make that decision in our mind that they are one of our spiritual teachers, because who we choose as our teachers is incredibly important. It affects not only this life but our future lives, you know, because our teacher is our guide on the path. And if we, you know, choose somebody who doesn't know the path very well or follows a mistaken path, then that's the road we'll go down too. And that has a lot of consequences in the long term. So it really behooves us to know these qualities of a teacher, you know, that they have good ethical conduct, meditative experience, they know the teachings on wisdom, they're teaching with a virtuous attitude, not just to collect a group of groupies around them or to get a lot of offerings, you know, that they have good scriptural knowledge. I would add, it's not listed in here, but I think that it's important that they have a good relationship with their own teacher as well. And that they're very patient, you know, so that they won't get fed up with us. They have enthusiasm for teaching, so that they'll teach us, you know. So to look for qualities like this. But then also, it's not like we're consumers and we're out there checking goods to purchase, you know. But we also have to come to the relationship with something. So we last week also talked about the qualities of a good student or a good disciple. So somebody who's open-minded, yeah, who's willing to listen to all sorts of different ideas, who is intelligent, you know, and will think about the teachings well, and they're able to discriminate and really, you know, between if something is correct or something incorrect. Somebody who's very sincere, we want to develop our own motivation and sincerity in the practice. Yeah. And then we talked about other qualities such as having confidence in the teachings, respect for the three jewels, respect for the spiritual mentor. You know, somebody, and we want to develop those qualities and also to abandon all of our wrong views. Yeah, so in that way, making ourselves into the most suitable disciple possible. So if we do our work and we choose teachers that have done their work or are doing their work, then things work out very well. Yeah, if, like I said before, if we choose teachers that aren't so qualified, it brings a lot of problems. And if we ourselves don't make an effort to become a qualified disciple ourselves, then we're kind of wasting our teacher's time. And again, our practice doesn't go anywhere because our mind's just too full of our own ideas and our own conceptions and our own likes and dislikes. Okay, so it's important for us to, you know, make ourselves into good disciples. Okay, so then, you know, we're talking about the actual meditation of how to rely on a spiritual mentor. I should say that sometimes this meditation, the translation, is guru devotion, and that is a wrong in translation. The Tibetan is Lame Tenpa. Lama is spiritual mentor. Tenpa means to rely or depend upon. Yeah. And the reason I point this out is the words guru devotion, I don't know about you, but for me it evokes a certain meaning that's very different than relying or depending on a spiritual mentor. When I hear guru devotion, I think of, you know, kind of Ali Ali Salami, you know, whatever it was, I'm devoted to you, I sacrifice, I surrender everything, like this, you know, which is not the correct way to relate to a spiritual mentor. You know, we don't sit there and just like gaze with eyes like big saucers at our spiritual mentor and say, oh, you're so precious, you're such a Buddha, you're so wonderful. That isn't the way to rely on a spiritual mentor. Okay? You know, to rely on a spiritual mentor really means that we listen to the teachings very attentively. Yeah? That we really take the teachings to heart. Yeah? And we try and put them into practice. Yeah? And in that way, we're really relying on a spiritual mentor in a way that is going to benefit us and enable us to benefit others. Okay, so it's not just a thing of devotion and worship. It's a thing of learning and putting into practice. Okay, so the when they give teachings on this topic, they always talk about the benefits of properly relying on a spiritual mentor. So I think it's helpful just to go over these rather quickly. One is we will become closer to awakening because we will practice what our teacher instructs and accumulate great merit by making offerings to him or her. So in terms of karma, there are certain objects meaning people, that we create stronger karma with. You know, for example, our parents, because of their kindness, the poor and needy because of, or the poor and sick because of their needs, okay, and our spiritual mentor because they're the one who guides us. So in the relationship with a spiritual mentor, we have the opportunity to create some very powerful merit if we rely on our spiritual mentors correctly. Yeah. And conversely, we have the opportunity to create a lot of destructive karma if we, you know, get angry and have all sorts of horrible thoughts. But one thing that's interesting in this, the benefit that we'll become closer to awakening, it's because we will practice what our teacher instructs, and we will create merit by making offerings. Okay, so it isn't like just, that's why I say it isn't guru devotion. The word devotion gives the feeling like all we do is have devotion, and that in itself is what brings the benefit. And it's not. It's what we do in response to depending and relying on a spiritual mentor. Okay? And then second, it pleases all the Buddhas. Yeah. So they say it's kind of like if you, you know, the teacher is the representative of the Buddha in that they're teaching us because the Buddha isn't here. So it pleases the Buddha when we rely on the teacher and when we listen to the teachings that come from the Buddha and put them into practice. It makes us, relying on our spiritual mentor, third, it makes us impervious to demonic forces and misleading friends. Okay, meaning that because we have practiced well and because we've accumulated merit, we're not going to follow misleading friends who teach, you know, who encourage us to do all sorts of negative actions. Okay? And then fourth, our afflictions and our bad behavior automatically is curtailed because our mentor teaches us what to practice and what to abandon. And then looking at our spiritual mentor as an example of the Dharma, then that too encourages us to let go of our bad habits and to practice good qualities. Yeah. And you can see this, that, you know, I mean, when you look at somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you listen to his teachings, and you see his behavior, then you go, oh, this is the real McCoy. Yeah? And this is the real McCoy. I'm going to rely on him. And as a result, you know, we start transforming our own behaviors, like, because he's a role model for how to be. And I know for myself, very often when I have difficulties or I find myself in difficult position, I'll think, you know, now how would my teachers act in this kind of situation? How would they think? What kind of attitude would they have? And how would they deal with it? And I find that very, very helpful. Yeah? So that's a benefit of relying on a spiritual mentor. Fifth is we gain higher paths and meditative experiences and stable realizations, again, through listening and practicing the Dharma. Six, we won't lack spiritual teachers in future lives. This, I think, is a very important benefit. Yeah? Because, you know, once you practice for a while, you really see how much you benefited from choosing a good teacher and letting that person benefit you, you know? And then you think, well, what would have happened in my life if I had not met that teacher? Yeah. And I know when I think about that, if I had not met my teachers, I would have made a huge, huge mess of my life and caused a lot of other people a lot of pain. Because I could see the path I was going down before I met my teachers. If I had continued down that, it would have been a mess. Yeah. So then, you know, I feel so fortunate for having met my teachers this life. So of course I want to meet good teachers in a future life. Yeah. So relying on our teachers this life creates that cause, you know, and prevents us from not having access to good teachers. Because if you think about it, you know, imagine what it would be like to have a lot of spiritual longing, and you have a lot of longing, yearning, interest, and nobody there to teach you. What do you do? Yeah, what do? You're like stuck, super stuck. Yeah. So we definitely want to create the karma to meet good teachers in future lives and not to meet bad ones. Yeah. I remember at one of His Holiness's teachings, this was after one of the Western Buddhist teachers' meetings, where we heard all sorts of stories about people and how they related to their teachers, and it was a real big eye-opener. So I was talking with Alex Burson at that time, he's an old friend, and we were sitting there marveling that we had met the teachers that we had met. You know, he and I had pretty much the same teachers, and how incredibly fortunate we were. Yeah, and it's like, how did we have that kind of karma to meet these people? And from our side, follow them. Why didn't we follow, you know, kind of some of these other weird teachers? Yeah? So, you know, we've done something right in a previous life. So, you know, then you want to do that same thing again in this life to be able to meet with teachers. Seventh, we won't fall to lower rebirths, again, because we listen and practice what our teacher teaches us. And then eighth, all of our temporary and ultimate goals will be effortlessly realized. So that includes all the seven previous ones. Yeah. And then the texts usually talk about the disadvantages of not properly relying on your teacher. So what this means is if you form a relationship with somebody as your teacher, and then your mind goes really, really negative about them, yeah, and you criticize them, you show contempt to them, you reject them, you renounce them, you harbor incredible anger, and you don't confess any of this. In other words, your mind really gets negative, and you just think your teacher's, you know, kind of... I mean, you think all sorts of negative thoughts, same way we do about... You know how we get when we get angry, yeah? And it's just, I'm fed up, I don't like this person, get rid of them. And so this... So if you do this kind of thing, then clearly that's going to be detrimental because you've already checked out their qualities and decided it was somebody reliable. Yeah. And then because of our own likes and dislikes and our own ego sensitivity and how easily offended we are and so on, then we get really mad at that same person who we had entrusted, you know, our spiritual guidance to, and say, then that's not going to be, it's not going to have a happy ending for us, is it? Yeah. Okay, so what happens if we have that kind of contempt and anger and, you know, reject the teacher, and we don't confess it, then the following things accrue. If, of course, if we do confess it, there's the opportunity to make amends and to purify and so on. Yeah. But sometimes, you know, you meet people that just turn away from everything with so much anger and resentment, and it's not at all helpful to their mind. Okay, so first of all, it's the same as showing contempt for all the Buddhas, because this is the person who's teaching us what the Buddha taught, and showing contempt for them. We'll be reborn in the lower realms, you know, having a lot of anger. Though we may try to practice Tantra, we won't attain awakening. Though we may put great effort into Tantra practice, all we'll wind up with is a hellish rebirth. We won't develop any new qualities or realizations, and what we have developed will decline, you know, by the force of this negativity in our own mind. And many unwished for things like sickness and calamities will befall us in this life, especially if we disrespect our teachers and lie to them. In future lives, we'll roam endlessly in lower realms, and we will also lack spiritual mentors in future lives. Okay? So you can see how that kind of result is simply a mirror reflection of how we're acting towards our teacher in this life if we have anger and resentment. And, you know, we're pushing them away with anger and resentment. So the boomerang effect, what comes back to us is, well, we pushed them away, now we don't have teachers in future lives. You know, we're angry, now what happens to us? You know, a very hellish kind of rebirth filled with a lot of pain and anger and so on. Okay, so what the point that they're getting at here in saying this is that it's very important once we've made that connection with somebody as our teacher, that we keep a good relationship with them. Okay. Now, of course, things always happen. Whenever you have human beings, yeah, things are going to happen. And especially with people like us, who have minds that are full of afflictions, you know, the Buddha could appear in front of us and we're going to be dissatisfied and critical. Yeah? I mean, we see even in the scriptures, there's stories of people. I mean, can you imagine having the opportunity to sit in the presence of the Buddha himself and your mind, you know, in the scriptures when you read it, people getting so angry, criticizing, oh, this guy, you know, Gautama, he doesn't know anything, he's just, you know, a farce, blah, 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 you know. And especially sometimes when the Buddha has to reprimand a disciple because they misbehave, then that person gets mad, and, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Yeah? To the Buddha. So, you know, so imagine what we're going to do. Yeah. I mean, it's entirely within the possibility of our own mind, isn't it? That, I mean, we get in a bad mood, we have a lot of anger, and our mind just sees, you know, everything that somebody does is wrong, it's negative, you know, they're insensitive, they don't care about me, all they do is criticize and humiliate me, they don't know the teachings, blah, 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 you know? Yeah? So, when we get like that, who are we damaging? Ourselves, isn't it? Yeah? So especially, you know, if you have a really good teacher and then you get angry and renounce that person, it's like, you know, what's going on here? That's not going to help us. Okay? But, of course, because we're sentient beings with afflictions, you know, and we have a lot of opinions, we have a lot of preferences, we are extremely ego-sensitive, aren't we? You know? Hello? Are you ego-sensitive? Shall I say something and we'll find out if you are or not? Yeah? So then, of course, you know, things are going to come up. So then the idea is, how do we keep a positive attitude when those things come up? Okay? So that leads us into the next point of the outline, which is developing confidence or convictional faith, faith, confidence based on conviction, based on understanding in our spiritual mentor. Okay? So, I'll continue reading the text as it reads here, and then I'll explain it, okay? So it says, visualize that the mentors with whom you have a direct spiritual connection appear from Guru Manindra, in other words, Buddha Shakyamuni's heart, and place themselves in the space in front of you. So you still have this visualization of the Buddha in front of you. So you imagine that from his heart come all your spiritual mentors that you have a direct connection with. And then you think, okay, my spiritual mentors are true Buddhas. In his precious collection of tantras, the complete and perfect Buddha said that in degenerate times, the conqueror Vajradhara will work for the benefit of sentient beings by appearing in the form of spiritual mentors. Accordingly, my spiritual mentors have simply shown an alternate physical form and are in fact the conqueror Vajradhara manifesting as spiritual mentors to guide those who do not have the good fortune to meet the Buddha directly. Guru deity, please inspire me and all mother sentient beings so that we may perceive our spiritual mentors directly as Manindra Vajradhara. In other words, as the Buddha. Okay? And then the text continues. In response to your requesting the Guru deity, five colored light, okay, white, yellow, red, blue, and green, five colored light and nectar stream from all the parts of, you know, the Buddha and all of our spiritual mentors from their bodies. It flows towards us, absorbs into our body and mind, so you can either imagine it absorbing through the crown of our head, going in, filling our whole body mind, or absorbing through all the pores of our body, yeah? But we have this incredible, brilliant light and nectar streaming from our spiritual mentors and from the Buddha, absorbing into us. It purifies you of all the negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time, and especially purifies all illness, spirit interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with directly perceiving your mentors as Manindra Vajradhara. Okay? So one thing it does is purify all these hindrances and illnesses and spirit interferences and obscurations and so on. The light nectar does that. Then second thing, all your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so on, expand and increase. Okay, so purifying and then bringing with it, you know, all the goodness and the realization so that your wisdom, lifespan, merit, and so on increase. Think in particular that a superior realization, the direct perception of these spiritual mentors as Manindra Vajradhara, arises in your mind stream and in the mind stream of others. Okay, so you do this visualization. Yeah? You make the request, you do the visualization. Okay, so now let's go and think about this a little bit here. Okay, so it starts out, my spiritual mentors are true Buddhas. Yeah, and then it talks about in the collection of tantras that the Buddha said that the conqueror Vajradhara will appear in the form of our spiritual mentors in degenerate times. So this kind of explanation is directed at somebody who is practicing tantra or who is about to take a tantric initiation. Yeah, it is not directed at beginners. Yeah. And it's not directed at people who aren't following the tantric path at this particular moment. Yeah. We still, and the reason is because when you practice tantra, you're trying to see even sentient beings as the Buddha. So of course you're going to try and see your teacher as the Buddha. And you're trying to see the environment as the pure land. But there's different kinds of spiritual mentors, and we see them differently according to the way that we relate, the kind of relationship we have with them. So His Holiness talks about, first of all, our Vinaya spiritual mentors. So this is the person who teaches us the Four Noble Truths, yeah, and everything to do with them, the path to liberation, who gives us our monastic vows, the five lay precepts. Yeah? And so, of course, we have respect for that person. We treat them as a representative of the Buddha. Then, second is we have those teachers or spiritual mentors who teach us the Bodhisattva path and who give us the Bodhisattva vow. Yeah, so who teach us the path of the six far-reaching practices, how to generate bodhicitta, and so forth. So those teachers, too, we develop respect for them, and we see them as emanations of the Buddha. Then it's only when we come to Tantra that we try to see the teacher as the Buddha, because, like I said, that we're trying to see everybody as a Buddha and the environment as a pure land. So His Holiness has been very clear that you know, this teaching is really not for everybody because it's very, seeing the teacher as a Buddha is very easy to misunderstand. And if it does, then if people misunderstand it, it's extremely detrimental for people and for the teachers. Okay? So, you know, in teaching this part on how to rely on a spiritual mentor, I'm going to teach it in a much more practical way, not so much related to Tantra, okay? Because that's the level we're at, or at least the level I'm at. So, okay? Yeah, when we had some discussions in 1993, and then it was, I think, 94, maybe it was 96, we had two Western Buddhist teachers' conferences with His Holiness. And this got discussed a lot in these conferences. And His Holiness was very clear that, you know, people have to be taught how to relate to the spiritual mentor in accord with their own level of practice. Yeah. And that this teaching that the Guru is the Buddha, if misunderstood, is very damaging. Okay? So then, how do we develop, because this is the part of the outline, is developing confidence and convictional faith in our spiritual mentor. Yeah? Because it's important, if we're going to study with somebody, that we have some kind of confidence in them. Right? We've checked out their qualities, we've decided and chosen that they're going to be one of our teachers. So how do we maintain a good relationship and continue to develop confidence in them? Okay? So, some people may find the fact that Vajradhara said, Buddha said this, conviction, but actually the quote says that the high teachers are the Buddha. Okay. But then also, our mentors are kind of like the media for conveying to us the enlightening influence of the Buddha. Okay? Our mentors inspire us. They help us to establish very receptive states of mind. Okay? And so, in that way, they're playing a very unique role in our lives. Wouldn't you say that? Those of you who have spiritual mentors, they have a unique role. And, in the present age, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are still working for the benefit of sentient beings. Yeah, and all of our qualities are due to the mentor who teaches us. Okay? So we try and see the teacher's good qualities. Yeah, and focus on their good qualities, not on what we perceive as faults. Okay? So to think of, how the Buddha guides and teaches people, and here is this person that's essentially serving the same purpose as the Buddha in relationship to me. Yeah. And then, when you study with somebody and you see their knowledge, you see their skill, you see their wisdom, then it increases your faith and you focus on those good qualities, and that helps you then, when you sit down to listen to teachings, to listen more attentively. Okay? So, the reason for seeing our teacher in a positive light is so that we will take the teachings more seriously when we hear them. If we don't see our teacher in a positive light, either we'll stop going to teachings, or we'll sit there and our mind will just, go through our checklist of faults and complaints, and neither of which benefit us very much. Okay? So we try and keep this positive attitude of faith and conviction in our teachers. Okay? So then the text continues here. Okay. It says, if the thought occurs, but a Buddha has eliminated all faults and possesses all good qualities, my spiritual mentors have such and such faults inspired by the three mental poisons. Yeah? So it's very easy. Yeah? Because we have our preferences and our opinions. We are highly judgmental and critical. And we could look at anybody and pick faults. Like I was saying, at the time of the Buddha, disciples pick faults with the Buddha. So our mind can, pick faults with our teachers. Yeah. So if such a thing happens, and if we start projecting, oh, my teacher has so much anger, my teacher has so much attachment, my teacher doesn't have any compassion, look at how they treat me, I'm such an eager, wonderful student and they ignore me. Yeah, they don't answer my questions. They don't pay attention to me. Oh, very easy to start thinking about like that, I'll finish reading this and then I'll tell you the story. So if that kind of thought arises in our mind, then we should think it is due to a false impression. In other words, it's due to our own mental projection. In the past, due to such false impressions or mental projections, Lekpe Karma saw all the activities of our guide, the Buddha, as pure deceit. Who wants that karma? You know? But if our mind gets negative, that's what happens. Okay, a Sangha saw Venerable Maitreya as a female dog. Okay, Maitripa saw the Lord of Yogis, Sharwaripa, kill pigs and commit great wrongdoing. Okay, so we wouldn't be the first ones to be very judgmental and critical of our teachers and to see them in a completely bad light. Okay, so then the text says, similarly, do my spiritual mentors really have these faults, or is it a mere impression? Is it just my projection? It is my projection. It is a false impression. Guru deity, please inspire me and all mother sentient beings so that the view of faults in our mentors may never occur, even for an instant, and that great faith and trust and confidence, which allow us to see only goodness in all they do, may easily arise in us. So we make that request to the merit field in front of us. And then again, as the same thing, a similar visualization happens. In response to your requesting the Guru deity, five colored light and nectar stream from all parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. It absorbs into your mind and body and those of all the sentient beings around you, purifying all negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time, and especially purifying all illness, spirit interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with not seeing faults in these spiritual mentors, even for an instant, and that interfere with developing great faith that allows you to see only goodness in all they do, easily arising within you. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. All your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth expand and increase. Think in particular that in you and others, the view of faults in your spiritual mentors no longer arises even for an instant, and that you have easily attained the realization of great faith and confidence that allows you to see only goodness in all they do. Okay? So, what's interesting here about the way this is taught is it's describing these requests and then the visualizations. Usually after we make the request, then we spend some time thinking about the points and the outline. Okay, so we would go through just what I was thinking about, what I was explaining before about, you know, how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas continue to benefit us, so they appear in these, you know, in these forms of our spiritual mentors, or they, you know, our teachers are the representatives or emanations of them in order to teach us. Because it's not like the Buddha attained Buddhahood and then said, bye everybody, I'm a Buddha, so long, good luck, you know, and then stayed in the Pure Land or, you know, entered into Parinirvana. The whole reason why they became Buddhas was in order to benefit sentient beings. So of course, you know, they're going to appear and there's going to be manifestations and representatives and so on, you know, in order to teach us. And so, you know, to think about that. And then also when our mind gets negative and picks faults, to think that those are our projections, okay? Now, it's important when we think that it's our projections. There's a lot to actually say here. We don't whitewash things, okay? If, let's say, for some reason, your teacher's really doing something unethical, you know, embezzling money or sleeping around or who knows what, it's perfectly fine to say, okay, there's a problem here, Yeah, and I need to talk to this person, or I need to notify their teachers, or something needs to happen and discuss this. You do not whitewash it by saying, oh, but they're a Buddha and this is all my projection. Okay, that is not helpful. Yeah, where it is helpful is when we see faults that are not, you know, the grave ethical downfalls, but things that do depend a lot on appearance and a lot on preference. Okay. Give you, let's see, I have many different examples. Yeah. Okay, so one of them. I'm a person who likes to get up early in the morning and practice early in the morning, do things in the morning, and in the evening I do not, my mind is not as sharp, you know, so I prefer to finish things, go to bed early, get up early the next morning, okay? One of my teachers, he loves doing things at night. He comes alive at night, yeah? So the teaching, and also he doesn't have, his idea of time is completely different than our idea of time, okay? So he might schedule a teaching for 7 o'clock in the evening, and you go there, and, you know, and there's no teaching at 7 o'clock, everybody's sitting there, and at 8 o'clock comes and goes, and 9 o'clock comes and goes, and 10 o'clock comes and goes. Maybe around 10:30 or 11, the teachings will begin, and then the teachings go all night long until about 6 in the morning. Now, for somebody like me, I don't like this. You know, I just don't like it. Yeah, because I am tired in the evening, and I hate falling asleep during teachings. I feel so disrespectful, and yet I'm exhausted, you know. And my mind then goes, but it's all his fault. Why does he start teachings, you know, so late? Why doesn't he just come at 7, finish at 9, then I'm okay, you know? Or how better yet, why not start at 10 in the morning and finish at noon, and you know, or 2 in the afternoon and finish at 4? That's good, you know? Why does he have to do so late? And even his own teachers told him he should stop early. Blah, 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 blah. Look, and the whole audience, we're all falling asleep. What use is this? It's totally useless. You know, why is he doing this? You know, and my mind can get, you know, if I let it, just get really critical. Yeah. What use is that? No use. My teacher has every right in the world to live his way, his life the way he wants to start and finish teachings the way he wants to. Unbeknownst to me until now, the whole world does not center around me and the time I want things to happen. You know? It's like this whole thing is not going to center around me and what's convenient for me, and I'm the one who has to adjust to what's going on. This is not a fault in my teacher. This is a problem that I have. Okay? So thinking like this. At one time, I was studying one of my teachers. You know, I always sat in the front row, kind of right in front of him, and I'm a person with a lot of questions. And, you know, so for a while he answered my questions, and then after a while I would sit there and he would answer everybody else's questions and wouldn't even look at me. You know, it's like, why isn't he looking at me? Why isn't he answering my teachers? My questions, you know? I'm such a good student. Why doesn't he answer my little bit of egotism and arrogance there. Yeah? So, you know, again, this is not a problem with my teacher. This is a problem with me. Yeah? Another example. Well, there's just so many. You know, where the mind just, you get jealous, you get arrogant, you get angry, you know, maybe your teacher's trying to help you and point something out to you, and, you know, it's like, why are they saying this to me? why are they doing this to me? And, you know, it's just they're trying to train us and help us. And then, you know, we just like, I don't like this. Yeah? And so that's clearly our own stuff, isn't it? Yeah? And, you know, if we get angry and we get offended and we get upset, you know, when our teacher's trying to teach us something, who loses out? We do. Okay. Now, you're going to say, but I saw my teacher get really angry. And it wasn't a me, it was somebody else. They have so much anger, such a bad temper. You know, they're full of defilements. Yeah? You know, you see your teacher get angry. So one of my teacher, one of my dear Dharma friends was telling me a story about her teacher. Because she was thinking this way about her teacher, getting very negative. Oh, my teacher is so angry and, you know, doesn't talk very politely to people, and such a bad temper, and, you know, what kind of teacher is this? And then my friend was telling me, but one day when she was with my teacher, when she was with her teacher, you know, they were talking about something. They got interrupted by a phone call, okay, and she could hear the dialogue between it. And her teacher was getting very, you know, somebody was calling to say blah, 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 complain about this or that or who knows what. And the teacher was, you know, scolding that person. Yeah. And then, you know, so it's the usual kind of situation, you know, where she's, oh, my teacher is so angry, is so full of anger and so scolding people. And then she saw, as soon as her teacher hung up the phone and turned back to her to continue what they were discussing, the anger was all gone. And then she went, oh, this is what was happening also when my teacher would get angry at me. She would be angry at that, you know, she would be scolding at that moment, but the next moment it was completely gone. And she saw in this instance that her teacher was scolding that other person because the other person needed to get scolded. Yeah. And then it made her think, oh, why was my teacher scolding me? Because I needed to get scolded. So it's not that my teacher is full of anger. It's my teacher is scolding people when they need to be scolded because at that particular moment in time, you know, say, talking sweetly to them, you know, it's not going to get across what that person needs to learn. Okay? So, you know, it was very interesting. I'm not telling the story as well as my friend did it, but did you get the point? You know, it's like all of a sudden she saw, oh, this is my problem. It's not that my teacher's full of anger. Okay? And so there's many kind of things like this that can happen with teachers. Yeah, I mean, all the time. And we just have to learn to work with it in our own mind. I had another friend who, with one of our teachers, she would actually quarrel and fight back with him. And he, this teacher, is, I mean, really quite an incredible, amazing teacher. But he thought George Bush was an excellent president. You know, he thought after 9/11, the U.S. needed a tough response. Yeah? And so he thought George Bush, you know, by going into Iraq was really doing the right thing. So, of course, you know, most of the disciples are like, God, how can Geshe-la think this? You know? It's like, does he really understand? Does he really know? And you know, one of the students, she was so upset by this. You know, how can he really think that George Bush is doing the right thing? And, you know, by that time, it was interesting because I had was older in years, so I had been through a lot of this kind of thing before. And it was like, in my mind, I don't care, it doesn't bother me that he believes in George Bush, you know? Because I came here to learn the Dharma from him. I didn't come here to discuss politics, you know? And he's entitled to have his political opinion. I'm entitled to have my political opinion. I don't really care, you know, but when it comes to learning the Dharma, he is a most wonderful teacher and realized being, and that's why I'm here. Yeah. So it was nice because for once I could see, oh, my mind, maybe I'm making some progress. Because here was, you know, my younger friend who was really upset by it, okay? So you learn after a while. You just have to let go of these kinds of things. And the thing is, when you practice like this in relationship with your teacher, it also helps you become more tolerant of other people. Because through these teachings, we know that our relationship with our teacher is very important. So then we're going to try harder to keep a good relationship with our teacher because we know how important it is for our own welfare, and we know the disadvantages that accrue if we don't keep a good relationship. So we try harder to broaden our mind, drop our judgments, stop being so easily offended in relationship with our teachers. When we practice this in relationship with our teachers, then it becomes with our teachers who of course are the people who are trying to benefit us the most. Then we can take it and practice it with other sentient beings. And it becomes much easier to practice because again, you take this same thing, you know, it's like this relative who I used to quarrel with about politics, well, you know, same thing as like my teacher. It's a free world. They're just their own opinion. It's completely okay. You know, I don't have to discuss politics with them. I'm not going to judge them for their political opinion. I'm just going to relate to them as a human being in the best way possible. And you see that you can do this now with some sentient being because you practice in this way in relationship to your teacher. Okay? Making some sense to you? Okay. So, if you have some questions, we can do some questions now. Yeah?
It's very hard for me to understand. I'd like to hear you say more. Many of your examples made sense to me, but the George Bush one was hard. The notion that if somebody's a very good Dharma teacher, how can they have opinions that appear to contradict the Dharma teaching? I think this is sort of the notion.
Okay. So if somebody is a very good Dharma teacher, how can they have opinions that appear to contradict the Dharma teaching? In this case, I don't think so much that my teacher was favoring war and wanting to go out and kill people. He certainly didn't have a harmful intent, but he really advocated a strong response. Okay? I think he also liked George Bush because as a Tibetan, you know, who saw how Tibet has suffered and been denied human rights under the communist Chinese government, the fact that George Bush was a little bit tough on China, he really liked that. Okay? So, I thought, you know, I mean, this is entirely his opinion and how he sees things, how he sees the world. I know he's not sitting there, you know, wishing a lot of people to die in the war. That's not in his mind. Okay, that I know. You know, and it's just, he's still like, you know, he can have his own opinion. Yeah? It's like I came here to learn the Dharma. I didn't come here to debate, you know, the advantages or disadvantages of, you know, a political response to something. Okay? So I didn't see him as going against the Dharma teachings. Yeah, because I know he wasn't wanting anybody to get killed. Now, if there is a teacher, let's say, because Guy mentioned it today, you know, about the Roshi, some of the Zen practitioners who favor the...
Oh, yeah. The Roshi and...
No, it was some of the... Yeah, no, it was some of the... At the time of World War II, they really favored Japanese imperialism. Okay, there were, you know, and this didn't come out until a few years ago, and some of the Zen students were horrified, you know, how could you have been pro-Nazi, you know, or pro-Japanese imperialism, yeah? So, for that kind of thing, you know, I would see it, you know, as either that person, their realization was not complete because it didn't profoundly influence all aspects of their life. Yeah, I would see it either as that or something else was going on there that I don't have all the information to know about. Yeah. But, you know, when you're following your teacher's example, examples like this, you don't take for yourself. If you see it's something that's clearly unethical. Okay, yeah.
So when meeting the person you have chosen as your spiritual teacher for the first time, what would be the proper etiquette?
Okay, so when you've chosen somebody as your spiritual teacher, what's the proper etiquette? Okay, we're going to get into that a little bit later where it talks about how to, you know, behave around our teacher, yeah? But in brief, I think the question is asking, are they asking more, not so much about attitude, but more about how to act? Okay. So that I'll talk about a little bit now. In general, you know, when your teacher comes into the room, you stand up, unless your teacher tells you don't stand up. Okay, in which case you don't stand up. You know, you just try and be polite and considerate. You look out and you see if they need something, if they don't need something. Generally, you would walk behind your teacher and your teacher would walk first. But if your teacher does not know where they're going, yeah, because, you know, they just arrived somewhere and they've never been there before and you know the way, then you walk in front and you show them the way. Okay? What else? I think, you know, be natural, be humble. Here's one thing. Don't try and put on a show in front of your teacher of being a good student. Yeah? Because you meet some people, when they're around their teacher, oh, they're so perfect, they're so polite, they're so humble, they're, you know, everything's like this. And then the moment the teacher's not there, they're bossy, they're loud, you know? Don't be like that. Yeah. I'm not saying to be bossy and loud with your teacher. I'm saying if you're trying to tame your behavior in front of your teacher, be consistent and treat others that way too. Okay? To establish a relationship with somebody as your teacher, there's different ways to do it. Sometimes just if you take any precepts with that person, that automatically establishes a relationship. That person becomes one of your teachers. You may go to that person and request them to be one of your teachers. If you do so, you would usually bring an offering and make a request. In my case, I knew so little. All I knew was that I went to these teachers, and when I thought about what they taught, it made sense, and when I practiced it, it helped me change my mind, and I just kept going back again and again and again and again. And eventually it dawned on me, oh, they must be my teachers, you know. And I never went and asked or anything like that, but it just kind of happened in a very natural way like that. Okay.
And why is it dangerous to misunderstand seeing the teacher as a Buddha? Question from Kala.
Oh, what's the danger in misunderstanding and seeing the teacher as a Buddha? Okay, if you misunderstand, okay, then, you know, what you're very likely to do is, if the teacher is not a highly realized teacher, and if the teacher does do some unethical behavior, then, because you've misunderstood seeing the guru, you know, as Buddha, then you think, well, those must be actions of the Buddha. Yeah? So my teacher is having sex with every woman in the center. Those must be the actions of the Buddha. It's completely okay. Yeah? That's not so good. Yeah? Or my teacher's, you know, taking money out of the, you know, the dana basket and putting it in his own pocket. That must be the actions of the Buddha. Yeah, so you don't say anything. That's not so good. Yeah? So if you have the correct understanding and you don't do this thing of kind of whitewashing and saying pink is purple and, you know, blue is green because you're trying to squeeze your mind into seeing everything as perfect. Yeah? If you have a proper understanding, then it's very helpful, you know, to see your teacher as the Buddha. But, you know, for people who are new to the Dharma, it's so easy to misunderstand it. And then you get into all this kind of gaga worship, you know, of somebody, which actually doesn't help. Yeah? Because then you sit around. Instead of, like, having real faith in your heart, because you've seen the teacher's qualities and because you've practiced what they've taught you, you have this very superficial kind of faith of, oh, my teacher's a Buddha, oh, my teacher's an incarnation of so-and-so. You know, he must be a holy being. Look what happened in his early life, this and this and this. Then you sit around the tea shops all day long talking about, my guru in his past life did this, and my guru in his past life did this, and you never practice because you're too busy with this, you know, aga-gaga movie star mind. Yeah? And then it doesn't last, because then the moment your teacher does something you don't like, then either you're completely fed up or you're back into saying, well, pink is purple, you know, and denying reality and not really working with your mind. You know? I mean, for me, in my own practice, it was so important. It was like, hey, people have their own choice of how to live their lives. And they may do things that don't make sense to me, but it's nothing unethical what they're doing. It's just a different way to deal with situations than I would. And I've got to open my mind and be more tolerant. So that was really helpful to me. You know, that way of changing my mind, I think, was much more helpful to me than just saying, well, it was the Buddha's action trying to teach me something when I have no idea what in the world they were trying to teach me. Yeah?
What's the most important thing we can do to never be separated from our teacher in future lifetimes?
The most important thing to do to never be separated from your teacher in a future lifetime is to listen attentively to the teachings and the instructions and put them into practice.
And practice?
And put them into practice. Yeah? And as a result of that, if you have faith and confidence, if you have respect and a sense of gratitude, you know, then you will always, too, be dedicating, may I meet perfectly qualified Mahayana and Vajrayana teachers in my future life. That kind of dedication will all automatically come to you. Other questions? Anything?
Yeah. Could you explain us about the emanation of the Buddha? Mm-hmm. How do you see that?
Okay, so in saying that you're the person who teaches you the Bodhisattva path mm-hmm. is an emanation of the Buddha. So how do I see that? Personally, I see that, well, as an emanation of the Buddha, as, you know, as the Buddha appearing in a different shape to teach me the Bodhisattva path. Or I see it as, you know, I might say the Buddha appearing as an ordinary being, because that's the best way to communicate with me.
I find it so difficult to separate from seeing the teacher as a Buddha and seeing it as
an emanation, yeah. Yeah, they're kind of similar, but saying somebody is different than saying kind of like they're an emanation of the Buddha. All these things that we're talking about, the basic bottom line point is how to keep a positive mental state regarding your spiritual teacher. It's not a thing of do you see them as a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or an emanation or a representative. The thing is, whatever way helps you to have a positive attitude towards your teacher and not give in to your own anger and ego sensitivity, use that. Yeah? And I think the reason they teach this as a representative, as an emanation, as a Buddha, is because if you think that way, then it can make you question your own negative emotions. Yeah? Like, if the Buddha were really here sitting in front of me, would I get angry like this? Yeah? Well, I better not, you know? I don't think I would. I would see that something else was going on here that I didn't quite understand. Okay? Okay, I had actually thought we would get further tonight, but we didn't. So we will continue, you know, with this next week. But in the meantime, this week, keep doing the visualization that we did at front. And now do a little bit of this contemplation about, you know, how to have a good relationship with your spiritual teacher. And reflect on the advantages of having it, the disadvantages of not having it. Think about, if you already have a spiritual teacher, think about, you know, situations in which you may have been angry or offended or critical or judgmental. And try and think of, you know, how else could you see that situation and keep a positive attitude towards that person. If you don't yet have a spiritual teacher, that's completely okay. You know, do some more reflection on what we talked about last week, which are the qualities of a teacher to look for, and think about why are those important qualities. Yeah. Okay. So do the closing mandala and the dedication.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West